Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solari Report. It's a great pleasure to welcome back a man who needs no introduction here, Richard Werner, who I think I always introduce you, Richard, as the top scholar in the world on central banking. And I, as you know, I'm very enthusiastic about your work. And one of the reasons is I worked on Wall Street for many years, and then I built a firm where we downloaded all the federal financial data and in relational databases and looked at by place. And those two experiences defied anything I learned in college economics or at Wharton about how markets and money work. And it wasn't until I found you that I found a scholar who could explain to me the phenomena I was observing. And so, you did, I always recommend, you did a wonderful speech in Malmo, Sweden in 2022 called The Case for Abundance. And your wonderful book, Princes of the Yen, on the Japanese Central Bank, as well as the documentary, Princes of the Yen, The Princes of the Yen. Those two bodies of work, I always try and get anyone who seriously wants to understand the economy to first read. And I can't recommend them enough. But as I was inspired to do this interview, you just did a wonderful interview with us when we published your marvelous study on why every state needs a sovereign bank. But I've been struck as I go around America as to the absence of an understanding in the leadership about the possibility of a reset where we can come out the other side, free people, and the economy can really work, which is what you described, among other things, in The Case for Abundance in that wonderful speech. So I wanted to revisit some of that material today because I want to make sure that policy makers who are really interested in freedom understand the economic piece. And I want to make sure that you and your body of work is on their radar because you're one of the critical people showing us the pathway through the forest. And I should also mention one of the reasons I feel so connected with you is you are, I would describe you as a devout Christian. Is that fair to say? And there's so many aspects of this which are spiritual warfare. So to get, you know, and I would tell everybody to go to your website because you have one of the most impressive resumes I've ever seen. And, you know, you read your resume and you think, I'm not going to like this guy. He's too, you know, he's too smart. But, you know, between Oxford and working in the investment world and your academic achievements. So your resume is very impressive, but you really do understand the spiritual warfare aspects of everything you're talking about when you look at economics and central banking. So to have, you know, to have a scholar with your credentials and your deep research also understand the spiritual aspects is just such a blessing. So
thank you very much.
So we're going to put you on the map in America, so to speak. Anyway,
talking about my resume, the appointments and positions I've had basically happened, I think, with divine guidance, because there's always been so much opposition. And so many times I've seen it that I had an amazing appointment, like at the University of Cambridge, and then it's gone before you know it. And so this happens time and again. But the ones that I've had, you know, I'm sure there was some strong protection. And yeah. also through my career, I mean, already in young years, I had the privilege of meeting some of the key players personally, which was always quite fortuitous, and I'm sure was arranged. You know, I met Alan Greenspan, I met, you know, all the big guys of investment banking and the fund managers, the big U.S. fund managers, whether it's, you know, Joe Soros, Stanley Druckenmiller, Dick Strong, Julian Robertson, and so on.
Right,
I mean, but also political figures. I've met some of the key figures, whether it's Vladimir Putin in person or others. Gorbachev I've met in person, Otto von Habsburg, and so on. So it's been quite a journey of discovery. And I always feel like, in fact, I use this in my book, Princes of the Yen, at the very beginning, one of the quotes is from the Bible. And it's the quote where you know, it said that basically you have to be like a child, because God takes pleasure in showing to little children what wise men cannot see. And that's how I've always felt, like God was showing me these things, and all these experts seem to have no clue.
Well, you know, I've had the same experience. The difference, though, is you then do the deep research. And, you know, I had a great infrastructure in Washington when I built my company in Washington, the goal of which was to help me do some of that research, although I'm not a scholar. And when I lost it, I realized there's no way I can rebuild it because they'll just take it again. But you've managed to do that deep research, and that when... for example, when you look at the study you did on should Tennessee start a sovereign state bank, that deep research is what is really necessary and compelling for policymakers. So it's an extraordinary body. Well, let's just dive in right at the banking part, and then we'll go to some of the other aspects of a case for abundance. But tell us a little bit about why banks are so important to a local and a global economy.
Yes, well, banks are really at the heart of what's happening in the economy. Now, ordinary people that have not studied economics often know this, and they've experienced this, and they know. You know, if you ask just random people in the streets, what's the most important thing in the economy? What are you thinking of when you hear economy? A lot of people, I'm sure, will say money, and a lot of people say banks. And that is quite accurate. Money and banks are at the center. And of course, they're tools. But they're tools that sort of got out of hand a bit, and the tools that need to be used in the correct way. Otherwise, things will go wrong. But they're very important and powerful tools. But when you study economics, you wouldn't know the least of that. I mean, you wouldn't know anything about banks because they're not even included in the models. It's really astonishing.
So I drove across America thousands and thousands of miles for years just trying to understand what was going on in the economy. And after you drive into your, you know, 5,000th town, you realize, oh, there's a bank, there's a courthouse, and there's a hospital. That's the control grid.
Yes, exactly. And of course, if they are local banks, then that is a good system, and it's a good way. Now, when you look at economics as a study, as a discipline, as a scientific research discipline, what is actually the result of the last 100 years, 200 years of economics? Of course, we've had fantastic progress in science, in physics, in chemistry, in engineering. There's absolutely no doubt we've had phenomenal progress. But what about economics? Now, that's a topic that they don't like you to consider. But there's a great article that came out in one of the leading mainstream economics journals, top-rated American journal, a journal of economic perspectives, and it's two Stanford University professors, so mainstream professors of economics, and they wrote about macroeconomics. And as part of that, in their introduction, they let slip the accurate track record of economics in the past century. Namely, I mean, they have a different purpose in their paper, but they thought this is a nice, catchy way of leading in. But by doing so, they revealed the truth. Namely, they said that what are the key questions we're asking in economics and macroeconomics? And then they say, actually, they're the same questions that economists have been asking for the past century. We're still asking the same questions. Of course, the implication is because we don't know the answers. And what are these questions? I mean, they're really basic stuff. Number one, what explains the business cycle, the up and down of the economy in the short term? And then number two, monetary policy. How does it work? Wow. Fiscal policy. How does it work? How does it affect the economy? And fourthly, they say, oh, and why do some countries do better than others? In other words, again, the same question as the first, what explains economic growth, but this time in the, you know, in the long run, and comparatively why some countries do better than others. So these are all very fundamental questions. And then they say, oh, newcomers to the field. So if you, you know, just joining as a student or whatever, to, new to economics, might wonder, how is it possible that we're still asking the same questions? And of course, the implication there is, why is it only newcomers that are surprised that we're still asking the same questions? Because if you're a newcomer, then you haven't been brainwashed yet, and you ask the common sense question, come on, guys, we're still asking the same question for the past century. There's something wrong. But once you've, you know, been indoctrinated studying economics, you give up asking that question. It's not because we know the answers. As mainstream economists, they don't know the answers. They just, they're trained not to ask that question. Shocking. And that's actually true. You know, there has been no progress in mainstream economics for, they admitted 100 years. I would say it's 200 years, actually, because it started with David Ricardo in the 19th century, this classical mainstream economics. And also, if you look at the world and economic policies, the most active institution in implementing cut and paste identical macroeconomic policies across the globe have been the IMF and the World Bank, essentially telling more than 100 developing countries for the last 70 years what to do. And they have means to enforce that, including, well, there's the carrot, money, and there's the stick. You know, if you don't, and if you break a promise against the IMF, then it would be serious consequences, down to various economic sanctions and you know, further regime change even as the next layer. So they've clearly had the power to implement their policies, and they have. And so officially, the goal has been to deliver economic development and prosperity. But, and they've done this for 70 years, given this advice and implemented it. But name one country in the world that, on the basis of this advice, has actually succeeded in moving decisively from developing country status to developed country status on the basis of these policies. There is not a single one.
Right.
There isn't any. So the track record has been dismal. Now, you could say, well, hang on, there's China, there's Japan, Korea, Taiwan. Well, Singapore. Well, yes, these in fact, I've just named the countries or areas that have been most, well, that have been the only ones that moved from developing country status to developed country status in the 20th century. There's only a handful. That was them. But they did this on the basis of very different policies from the IMF and World Bank policy. In fact, what they've been doing has been forbidden explicitly by the IMF and the World Bank, and is essentially been the opposite of what the IMF and the World Bank have been saying. So the track record in economics is dismal. Now,
well, I would say that the leadership specifically allowed them to develop. So there were, you know, certain countries, think of it like a license, and they had a license to truly develop.
They had a license to take the right development policies. You're right. Because, for example, other countries like Germany, they currently are being given the job to deindustrialize and create a massive recession and bring Europe's economy down. And that is what's currently happening in Europe. So, yes, there are behind the scenes parameters. Still, the fact is we also need to know what are these policies, and we should demand them, because, you know, that's back to your question. We can have prosperity everywhere. Right. We don't need to have underdevelopment. We don't even need to have a recession. It's totally unnecessary. And that is the shocking thing. Once you realize, because when you study economics, they certainly won't tell you all these things. But the fact is,
I just want to point out, and you were very clear about this in Malmo, we can do it with while healing the environment. This does not have to be environmentally damaging whatsoever. Quite the opposite.
Exactly. Right. Now, that's the other red herring, and misinformation that's been spread. I mean, it started really half a century ago with this report by or for the Club of Rome, Limits to Growth. And since the 70s, since 1973, they've been very proactive in proclaiming and getting the UN involved and proclaiming that economic growth is actually bad and there's limits and we're depleting the environment and it's all bad. Now, I think we all agree we need to protect the environment and
yes.
pollution of the environment is bad and we should avoid it and there should be measures in place to do that. But that's actually not the point, because what they're arguing now is economic growth is the enemy. And they've argued this since this, you know, Club of Rome study, limits to growth. First of all, there are no limits to growth.
Right.
That's already completely false.
So all my, ever since I did the relational databases and the simulations in the 90s, I said the only limit to growth is our imagination, because exactly. intellectual capital can add fantastic amounts of living and financial equity infinitely. It's a matter of our time and imagination. And then I forget how you said it in Malmo, but you said essentially the same thing. And I was just like, oh, thank God, finally a
yes.
scholar
it
who
is
can explain
absolutely
this.
True. It is yeah. absolutely true. In yeah. fact, yes, let me explain this, why this is true. First of all, this claim that growth is the enemy, and therefore they're even arguing now we need degrowth, we need like reduced growth. In fact, we need to have zero growth or negative growth, which is quite extraordinary. That's complete nonsense. So first proof that this is nonsense is just imagine we've succeeded. In fact, Germany has succeeded, right? So Germany has had zero or negative growth for the last year and a half, and that's still ongoing. Okay. So they've got degrowth. Congratulations. So does this mean that there's no environmental pollution in Germany? And there's no, you know, suddenly we don't have to worry about environmental damage? No, it doesn't mean that. We still have to watch out. In fact, late last year, gave permission to entirely erase an ancient forest that's almost as old as
oh,
the Roman
kidding.
Empire. Yeah, goes back to almost the Roman era. And the Germans love their forests and they've become,
right.
you know, smaller and fewer. But it's an ancient forest is being... was cut down in order to install, you guessed it, photovoltaic panels, you know, for solar energy. It's
oh my
ridiculous.
God.
The other thing that cutting down trees for and you know, damage the environment is, of course, the wind turbines.
Right.
Now, Canadian government is another case in point. So they have all sorts of woke and allegedly, you know, degrowth and environmentally friendly policies, and they're clearly not in favor of growth, yet they continue to cut down these ancient giant trees, you know, these 2,000-year-old giants. And that's still happening. And the population the local population in Canada is demonstrating and is trying to get the government to protect them, but they're not. So you see, it's not about protecting the environment.
Right.
And so the first point is, even at zero growth, we still have to watch out because you can still damage the environment. So it's not really growth that's the issue. It's environmental damage that we need to stop. Now, so what about growth itself, economic growth? Well, here's the other second proof why economic growth is not the enemy at all of environmental protection and environmental sustainability. It's because economic growth is just a statistical concept. That's all it is. It's nothing physical. It literally is not. GDP is nothing physical. It is a statistical concept, and a statistical concept cannot hurt the environment.
Right.
Now, it is, and in fact, I dug into the history of the statistical concept because, you know, I found empirically when I studied the various data series and also trying to debunk the false economics. You know, for example, there's this, actually, let me start with this, because the one thing that all these different schools of economic thought agree on is if you lower interest rates, you get higher growth. And if you raise interest rates, you're slowing growth. And whether you're a classical economist like David Ricardo or neoclassical like Alfred Marshall, or you're Keynesian like Keynes or the followers of Keynes, Tobin and whatever they're called, or whether you're a Friedmanite monetarist, or more recent, you know, real business cycle, a dynamic stochastic general equilibrium, macro models, or even alternative approaches like Austrian economics, they all agree on this. By the way, they're all equilibrium economics. They talk about equilibrium. We'll come back to that. And they all agree on this point that if we lower rates, that leads to higher growth. And if we raise rates, that slows growth. And of course, central bankers have been propagating this for the past, well, half century at least, on a daily basis. And the journalists have been, just parroting it. And because it's been repeated so much, everyone assumes, and clearly lay people quite rightly assume, well, if that's what all the experts are saying of all these different schools of thought, surely it's true. And surely there's hundreds of studies that have long demonstrated this, and it's proven, done and dusted. Well, I looked into it because I always found that when I did empirical work that it wasn't true, and the truth seemed to be the opposite. But, I try to be careful. And so I said, okay, well, let's do a proper study on this. And what I found is that, there's not hundreds of studies proving this. In fact, there's not a single one. There's zero studies proving this. There is no evidence for this whatsoever. So then I got a top econometrician, and we worked on this because it was clear to me that it would be very carefully examined, and it had to be state-of-the-art econometric statistical techniques. But and we did, for the first time, an open-ended piece of research where we just say, okay, what is the relationship between interest rates and economic growth? And instead of the official narrative that, lower rates lead to higher growth, higher rates lead to lower growth, we found that interest rates and growth are not negatively correlated, but the opposite, positively correlated. And the direction of causation is not from interest rates to growth, but from growth to interest rates. So it's the opposite of reality, what they're telling us.
Right.
Reality is the opposite. It's not negative correlation and causation from interest rates to growth, but a positive correlation. And so it's really growth driving interest rates and being positively correlated. And then the next question I had was...
So I just have to stop you and insert one thing, because as interest rates came down from the 80s on, I started really tracking in the 90s where the money was going, and then kept tracking it sort of as I rolled around over the last two decades. And I saw... as part of this, there was a whole regulatory package that came with it. So it was both the lower interest rates and the regulatory package. But the goal was basically to move money from the productive to those who were centralized in control. So you were sucking money out of the productive part of the economy and trying to shut it off and move it to those who are centralized in control, who happened in many respects to reduce productivity. And it was
It came with
a regulatory package, right?
Exactly. In fact, the question, where did the money go, is the question that economists asked in the 70s and then 80s, because they noticed that the old quantity theory, money is related to nominal GDP, wasn't holding anymore. The money supply was rising, but GDP was not really rising as much. So where's the money going? And
right.
I solved that puzzle as well with my general quantity theory by showing that this was a special case, because they're assuming quite wrongly that all money goes into GDP. It's not true. They leave out financial transactions, asset transactions. They're not part of GDP. And of course, money is used for them. And in fact, nowadays in many countries, most of the money is used for these asset purchases, purchase of property rights, financial assets, and so on. And therefore, we have to split money into two streams, money to the real economy and money for asset transactions. And then the puzzle is solved. That's where the money went. It went increasingly not into the real economy, not, as you say, for productive investment, but into asset purchases. And so the chain of causation is this. The money creation, and we have to talk about that next, because that's, of course, what banks do. They create money. That's driving this. The money creation process, and it's controlled ultimately by the central bank behind the banks, that's driving the economy and asset markets. And the amount of money that's created by banks for productive business investment, that determines your economic growth. But they've been reducing that. Therefore, growth has come down. And as growth comes down, interest rates follow and come down. And that explains why rates have been coming down and down and down. Of course, they reversed that when in March 2020, they adopted my QE2 proposal, which originally developed for Japan, 1995, quantitative easing for a deflationary shrinking economy. You want to kickstart the money supply. The central bank can do that. I argued if it buys assets from non-banks, and then it's forcing the banks to create credit and push it into the economy. But they did this in March 2020, the Federal Reserve. And you had noticed this BlackRock plan, which was quoting my QE2. They call it, as you pointed out, going direct. And they did this in March 2020, which is massive money creation. So 18 months later, we had to have significant inflation because they're revving up nominal GDP growth, which is what they did. And then rates go up. And so this is really the chain of causation. Now, just to come back to the earlier point, you know, about degrowth and GDP, I also wondered, well, okay, so why do we observe then that nominal GDP growth and nominal interest rates, the 10-year benchmark bond yields, they're almost, you know, identical. They always move together with growth, the economy usually slightly faster first, and then interest rates following. But they're almost always at the same level. And why should that be? And I had this hypothesis. I thought, well, actually, what is GDP? You see, it goes back to how GDP was designed. And I said it's a statistical concept, but who designed it and for what purpose? It had a purpose when it was designed.
Right.
Now, I thought surely it was designed by the bankers, and it was designed to gauge the ability to pay for a whole economy, the ability to service debt, which the bankers were happy to lend. The best borrower is always the government because it has the power to impose taxes on all of us to pay back the bankers' loans, which is the old trick. That's why we had then the creation of the privately owned central banks and so on. So, but that from that follows that if you're a banker, so you want a good measure of the ability of an economy to generate income. That's why GDP, I mean, it's a product type, but it's equal to national income and is equal to national expenditure. They're identical. And it's really the income side the bankers are interested in because you, so because it tells you how much can we raise rates.
If you're going to put the whole society in a debt trap, you need to know how much you can push the limit.
Yes, exactly. And of course, if you want to max out in the long run, then you don't really want to overdo it because that leads to a crisis, maybe too early, or the type of crisis you don't want. The ideal situation is where you max out on the interest rate. It's very high, but just bearable. Because if, and that means interest rates are as high as income growth, GDP growth. If interest rates are higher, then clearly you can't service it. Now, that is possible for some countries when they are the anchor of the monetary system, like the US, but that's a special case. But the original logic for defining GDP was to find out what is the ability to service debt. And now, so next I thought, okay, so if we want to find the origin of national income accounting, my bet is we have to go to England, just around the time the Bank of England was created, 17th century. And bingo, that's exactly, I mean, basically you find things when you know the answer and you know where to look. So I found that is where national income accounting started. There's two guys who worked for the Dutch original founders of the Bank of England. And they worked already in the years beforehand. Their job was to gather the statistics on economic transactions, incomes, taxes, and then put it together. It took a few years, and it was just ready just in time for the launch of the Bank of England in 1694. I write about this in a little booklet I've just published called my advice on long-term sustainability, I can give you the link. So that's actually where this GDP comes from. So it's designed by bankers to get the ability to service debt. That is the original meaning, and that explains why, surprise surprise, you know, 10-year interest rates, long-term interest rates, and GDP are actually usually around the same levels, and interest rates follow GDP.
So we saw something quite extraordinary in America in the 80s and 90s, because we saw the legalization of usury. And one thing that happened is the interest rates came down, it came down for certain sectors, but other sectors it went up. So we literally saw, you know, for periods where the New York Fed member banks can borrow at 0% and the average American credit card is 17%. And the arbitrage between the retail rates and the bank rates are extraordinary.
Yes, of course. And essentially, the monetary system is the tool that is used to distribute wealth. And right. Another key example on how massive this impact is the prediction of Keynes, who 100 years ago was forecasting what is the world going to be like 100 years in the future, which is now. And it's really interesting to see his figures, because he, using previous data on productivity, he came up with this calculation, and he predicted that as a result of all this productivity growth and income growth, we would not have to work anymore in 100 years' time, which is now. Which, yeah, you've got to laugh. Particularly in America, it's quite clear that since the beginning of the 70s, working hours have increased. And now, you know, both parents in the household have to work, and sometimes several jobs. So it's really the opposite of what he predicted. But then you look into his detailed calculation, it gets more and more shocking, because his numbers were correct.
Right.
His numbers were actually correct.
So they've been able to centralize all the growth. I mean, exactly. All the equity growth. I just have to give you a statistic. So I just looked at the average holiday period between Europe and the United States, and Northern Europe was 40 to 50 days a year. Guess how much the Americans were?
5 days? I don't know.
10.
10, okay. 10.
Yeah, and many Americans are 5. So, yeah.
Yeah, probably, yeah. Yes. Right. Oh, yes, of course. And I guess, you know, it's payback time now for Europe.
Right.
The idea is that they've had it too good for too long, and so all that's going to change now. But so, you know, if you look at these calculations by Keynes, he correctly predicted the productivity growth. Now, that is really the wealth creation, because it is productive capacity, new ideas, new technologies, that creates productivity, creates value added. And he was correct. In fact, we're at the upper end of what he predicted. Secondly, based on that, you expect income generation to take place. And that's also there. So the income did take place, you know, the income growth. And yet most people have to work. More people have to work more than ever before.
Right.
Why is that? Because the one thing that he did not fathom, that he could not have predicted, he could not have imagined to be a problem in this, is that despite all this wealth having been created so that we don't have to work anymore, he could not have foreseen that everyone has to work, because a tiny, tiny minority got all the wealth.
Right.
So the distribution of the benefits from growth has been so unequal that the outcome has been much worse.
I wouldn't say secret, but if you look at how extraordinary it is that, you know, there is not a popular consciousness of how extraordinary it is.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And basically, the middle class has been hurt in the last half century, and that's accelerating. And that, of course, is the majority. So it's really the squeeze of the middle class that's the big problem. And that affects very much living standards, quality of life.
Right.
So what is the mechanism that Keynes underestimated in its importance? It is the monetary system. That is the mechanism to distribute resources. And so then the question is, and you know, so why has economics been so unsuccessful, and why have these predictions and even Keynes's prediction been so wrong? Well, because they don't understand the monetary system. Economic theories have totally ignored money and the money creation process. The textbooks will say, well, the money comes from the government or the central bank, and most people, ordinary people, will have that sort of assumption. Well, it's something very public. Clearly, it's important. Mm-hmm. Who creates money and how is it created? So surely they figure this one out, and surely it's either the government or the central bank. But actually, the reality is this is not the case. The central bank only creates around 3% of the money supply. 97% is created by banks. banks are actually the money creators. And that's been the system that we've had. Now, that actually has been a blessing in many countries, including the US, because it's meant decentralized money creation.
Right.
And the quickest way to understand the importance of this, if we look at China, which started out under Mao, having a communist, Stalinist, central planning, very centralized economy, where you know, a small group of central planners decide everything, and that includes the monetary system. So you had one, you know, one bank only, the People's Bank of China. You don't need more banks. The People's Bank of China had many branches, but it's just one bank. And so you've got a small group of central planners deciding how much money to create and who gets it. Well, famously, that system was not very successful. and the Soviet Union has demonstrated that over an even longer time period. And when Deng Xiaoping came to power in China, he was keenly aware that the Soviet system is failing. And he decided, well, we quickly better change that. Otherwise, you know, it's not good for the people in power if it fails, as happened in the Soviet Union. So he radically switched. First of all, he switched his methodology, his approach. He said, let's drop ideology. And of course, he was thinking of communist ideology, but it's something we all should just think about. Let's drop ideology, which means essentially political fixed ideas that we like, but they're not based on scientific evidence. Instead, let's just look at data and facts and let's do what works. He adopted the empirical approach, the empirical methodology, the inductive methodology.
Now, and he unleashed entrepreneurs.
Exactly. But that's something that Western economists have not done yet. They stick to ideology. You know, Western economics is ideological economics, where you have axioms, assumptions, and you create a fictional, you know, theory, model, a fictional world. That's not based on evidence.
You're much nicer than I am, Richard, because I just think it's an official narrative that helps the central bankers engineer where they want to go.
Well, that's true. That is also true. That is true. So, yes, you can also call it just the propaganda narrative, while really, of course, they're adopting a different approach. And that is precisely accurate. So now, in terms of the banking system, what did Deng Xiaoping do when he came to power? He went to Japan. He studied Japan. He studied Germany. And he realized, and probably the U.S. as well, it's better to have hundreds of banks, thousands of banks. And that's exactly what he did. So he switched from a system where you had maybe five people determining centrally the money creation and allocation to a system where you have currently, you know, around 5,000 banks, and each bank will have dozens of branches, and each branch will have dozens of loan officers. In fact, in total, you will have hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of loan officers across the country, and they accept applications and they make calculations. They're kicking the tires. And then tell me, which system is likely to be more successful, where you have got five central planners deciding the whole economy and money creation for the whole country, or where you have a million people on the ground constantly engaging with entrepreneurs, with proposals, with applications from small firms, kicking the tires, checking it out, and then making decisions.
And knowing, because this is relationship banking, knowing the quality of the people they're dealing with.
Exactly. And that you can only do it when you're on the ground, local bank, local branch, and you know your customers. Exactly. And that's actually why it's been a blessing that America has so many banks. And we had this decentralized money creation system. Of course, behind the scenes, it's being manipulated by the central banks, because that's this. So really, with the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, that's when the central planners came on stage behind the scene, and they've been manipulating things ever since. And their goal has been to control the money creation process. First step was really the 1930s. Now, the Fed was created against lots of skepticism. The majority in Congress was really against it, so they used the trick. You know, they did it just before Christmas, when nobody was there. It was the voting on it in December 23rd of December, 1913, was very badly attended just by the ones that knew about it and were voting in favor. But the main promise to persuade even those that it's a good thing was, well, if you have a run on a bank, even the best bank, the strongest bank, will fail if you don't have a mechanism to step in and help the bank. And if we have a Federal Reserve, then that's the mechanism. That was the promise. Now, this is actually true, that if there's a run for some, you know, reason, some panic created with some false rumors, it can bring down a bank if there is no mechanism. But when this happened,
if you have a mechanism that's starting the runs, it's a different kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Now, in the 1930s, what happened was more than 10,000 banks in America went bust. These were the many small local banks. And what did the Federal Reserve do?
Nothing.
And again, last year in March, Silicon Valley Bank and a few other banks, they went under. What did the Federal Reserve do? It was the biggest run ever on one single bank on Silicon Valley on that day, $41 billion taken out through the FedNow system. So the bank couldn't even stop it anymore. They piloted with the Fed. So the money was carried out through the Fed system. Did the Fed step in? No, not before it was closed down.
One of the largest owners of the New York Fed and one of the most active agents for depository for the U.S. government was in fact on the other side. They were helping them go down. They were poaching them and they were exploiting the whole situation.
Exactly.
Quite the opposite.
Precisely. So the whole thing, I mean, if you look in the details, it looks extremely orchestrated. But again, that's been the record of the Federal Reserve. So the promise was, you need a Fed, then you can step in when there are runs on banks. Well, they didn't step in the 1930s. And that's how the face of America was changed dramatically in the 1930s. And you mustn't forget that at the same time in the Soviet Union, they were doing the collectivization. Farmers' land was stolen by the government. And they created these huge kolkhozes, agro combines. Well, actually, the same thing was done in the U.S. through the banking system, through the Federal Reserve, because what happened was that 10,000 small local banks, farmers' banks, that had lent to local farmers were bankrupted. The Fed did nothing to step in. And these banks were then gobbled up by big banks that were part of the Fed system with the Fed backing. Now, were the borrowers from these banks let off? No. The depositors lost all their money, but the farmers had to still repay their loans. And of course, they couldn't because they just crashed
the economy.
It was
a huge land grab. It was an engineered land grab.
Absolutely. And as a result, there was literally starvation. I mean, they hit the farmers. Right. Farmers were suddenly expropriated. They lost their land. Right. And they had no more job. They had no more way to feed themselves or feed America. There was literally starvation. Just read John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, for some very accurate details, better details than in any economics book about what's been happening.
So I want to stop you right now and just repeat some things just for non-economic people in the audience to really get this point. So when you have lots of small banks and they know their economy, the more loans they make to productive activity, and again, only imagination ultimately limits productive activity, the more growth you get that can be environmentally not damaging and can be good for everybody. So you're talking about prosperity.
Exactly.
So you have a engine to create prosperity on a decentralized basis, and it is intentionally shut down in a way that central powers can grab the land.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
This is what happened in the 30s. And this is one of the things it's so important to me to prevent from happening again, because it looks like all the forces are arraying to, they're working up to a couple things, but one of which is a land grab. And so it's so important to understand this point that there is a prosperity engine. There's no economic problem. There's a prosperity engine and somebody's shutting it down so they can do a land grab.
Absolutely.
And that prosperity engine must be protected at all costs.
Exactly.
And there's no reason to think that it can't be highly successful economically.
Exactly.
And I just, I just want to make one point. When interest rates were coming down, the bank regulation hitting the community banks in America was forcing them to put everything into their investment portfolio and stopping them from making loans on Main Street, which are the engine of prosperity.
That's right. The Basel, these are the Basel capital adequacy rules,
right?
Which in the US, I mean, to be fair, unlike other countries like in Europe, have only been adopted by the big banks. In Europe, the small banks also have to adopt them. But still, it did affect also the regulation of small banks. And they're encouraged to lend for asset purchases, not for the real economy. In fact, you're punished as a banker if you lend for productive business investment. You have to have more capital. And if there's collateral, property, real estate collateral, then you have to hold less capital. And therefore, you earn more money if you lend for the wrong thing. So this was done by the Basel central bankers. Yeah.
Well, but there was another part of this dynamic, Richard, and that was as the interest rates came down, of course, the government borrowed more and more, putting everybody in the debt trap. But then the government would subsidize massive amounts of activities locally, getting more and more of the economy dependent on federal subsidy. And yes. So you're shutting off the private entrepreneurial activity and re-engineering the entire local economy into a not just a debt trap, but a government subsidy trap.
Yes. So centralization has been the goal, and it's centralization, takeover of land and farmers and farms. And that's been essentially what the central planners in the background have been aiming at. But maybe just to reiterate this point you're making, which is a very fundamental, very important one. So when a bank creates money through lending, you know, every loan, that is new money creation, new money that's added to the money supply. There's essentially three possibilities. If the money is used for consumption, then you get consumer price inflation because you're adding to the money supply, but you're not adding to the amount of goods and services. You have suddenly more demand chasing the same fixed amount of goods and services. Of course, you get consumer price inflation. That's the special case that earlier economists thought is the only case. But there's two other cases. If bank lending is used for asset purchases, property purchases, or also financial assets, then you may not get consumer price inflation. In fact, this has been shown in many countries. But you will get asset inflation because the asset will be the collateral. And it's clearly then, because it's money creation, these loans, it will drive up these asset prices. And that's been happening, of course, in the US and the UK. We had a huge asset bubble in Japan in the 80s. Only now has the Japanese stock market recovered beyond the peak of the bubble of the 1980s, peaking in 1989. Only just now, just the last few days, have they managed to come back, you know, after so many decades. So that's the second possibility. Bank credit for asset purchases results in asset inflation, and then usually banking crises because you're leveraging the banking system more and more, and you're driving up asset prices, usually 100%, 200%, 300%. But from the peak, they only need to drop by 15% from the peak, and your banking system is bust because it usually only has equity amounting to 15% of the balance sheet. Right. But if banks have non-performing loans, it has to come from equity. So when asset prices fall, then the property lending or, you know, asset lending will turn into non-performing loans. And only after 15% drop, you've wiped out equity. That's why we have the recurring banking
crisis. Then you can pick up a lot cheap.
Sorry?
But it's a great opportunity to pick up things cheap.
Of course, right? Of course, which is why we get these recurring banking crises essentially engineered by the insiders. But the fact is, it's true what you said earlier, that we don't need to have this resource misallocation. Even if a crisis happened, there are ways out of it very quickly at zero cost to the taxpayer. But usually they're not taken because they actually like the crisis they're abusing it for, you know, transferring resources. But let me just mention the third possibility. And that is, of course, the redeeming feature of banking. When banks lend for productive business investment to create new goods and services, then you get actually sustainable income flows to service and repay the loan. So these loans are actually the safest, and they should have the lowest Basel bank regulation capital adequacy requirement, but they don't. So you see, it's wrong, you know, this Basel approach. But of course, they've done this on purpose. But so this lending creates economic growth and prosperity. And what is the limit to this? There is no limit.
No limit.
The only limit is new ideas, new technologies, which is human ingenuity. And as you've said, there is no limit to that.
Right.
That means, of course, we can have 10% growth, we can have 15% growth, 20% growth. It's all possible. So much prosperity. What is holding us back
is
currently our lack of knowledge and the wrong use of the system. Right. You know, because we have a banking system. America has a good decentralized banking system. So the infrastructure is there. It's just being wrongly applied. Right. And so we artificially have far lower growth. And you pointed out in the last few decades, economic growth going down and down and down and down. And the number of banks going down, the Fed keeps killing banks. It's killed 10,000 banks in the last 40 years. The ECB has killed 5,000 banks in the last 20 years. And of course, growth goes down as the central right. bankers don't allow banks to create more credit. They give the wrong regulatory incentives. And that means there's less prosperity than there should be and there could be.
Richard, if you want to use new technology to build total central control, I would say the system is working quite well.
Yes, exactly. It's working right. for the central planners, and it's been abused right. and distorted for the aims of the central planners.
Right.
But we have to reclaim it. And so people should be aware that there's nothing, intrinsic that prevents us from having more prosperity. We can have abundance, and this can be built. Because America is a federal and a decentralized state, politically and also economically, there's a lot that can be done on the state level.
Right.
Because, as I said, the infrastructure is there. We just have to slightly rejig it and make it as easy as possible, for example, for banks, for local state-level banks, to decouple from the system.
I want to stop you now and describe my greatest concern about what is happening at the state level and why it's so important that we all start listening to your work. If you come to most states, especially in the southern states, people own a few resources. They have a bank account, they have cash, so they have dollars, and then they have real estate, and they may have a small enterprise or a small farm. What they don't have is they don't have gold and silver. Few may, but not a lot. And what they don't have is they don't have big Bitcoin or crypto positions. A few might, but it's relatively a scarce resource. Because the Constitution provides for states to issue silver and gold coin, you have a huge push to get banks or states to do bullion or to do digital bullion systems, you know, combined with crypto, all of which I think are good ideas. But if they're the only thing that happens, you're going to wake up where the vast majority of the population, if the Fed plays games or shuts off or controls dollars, they're completely in a short squeeze and they suddenly have to sell their land to get gold or crypto. And if that's their only transaction option, it's devastating.
Exactly.
Which brings us back to the fact that it is absolutely, to me, the number one priority of any state should be to create a state sovereign deposit banking depository, which if the Constitution says you can't own a state, you can have the state charter banks get together and do the equivalent of the New York Fed for your state, right?
Exactly.
So it can be privately owned, but it's dedicated to preserving an open cash and checking and clearing system for under state law within that jurisdiction. And then as part of that, you need to do everything you can to preserve, you know, the number of banks you have and not let your banks get run or consolidated.
Exactly.
That has to be number one, because everyone, the state, the local government and the citizens are totally dependent on dollar liquidity. And without that, we're all toast.
And, exactly.
Right.
I totally agree. Exactly. So as you say, I mean, I also think it's good to have gold and to have gold-based mechanisms, but also we shouldn't just rely on that, because not everyone will have gold. And they,
right.
You see, the advantage of the banking system has been that when we, okay, here's an entrepreneur, has got a great idea, even an idea that is of a public importance, will create a lot of prosperity for everyone. Surely we want this idea to be implemented. But let's say that, you know, we have a system where the money supply is fixed by the amount of gold we have, and it's currently already deployed. So we just unfortunately can't give purging power to this entrepreneur to implement the ideas. That's the system without a bank, when there's no bank. And what a bank can do is it does make this assessment. It, you know, very critically right. looks at loan applications. Is there value added in this? Is this viable, you know, looking at the financial projections and so on? And then the bank has the right to create money. Now, that's something we can do and states can do, because the amazing thing is that while banks have essentially the monopoly on money creation, the money that they create is not legally privileged, because mm-hmm. it's simply private company credit. That's right. all it is.
Right.
And therefore, there is nothing to stop a state-level public institution, or of course also private institution, if they have enough backing from the public, to create alternative private company credit to expand purchasing power and implement these great ideas that we need. An example.
Right. If you yeah. walk into my bank up in the boardroom, they have frames of the currency that they issued long
exactly.
ago.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right.
And that shows it, because we call it banknotes for a good reason. It used to be every bank issuing right. their notes. Paper money from the Federal Reserve at law is still only a promissory note.
Right.
And that's what all these banks in the past were allowed to issue. That's what banks do. And then you could see the money creation much more directly, because, you know, essentially when you got a loan, they would give you the money they'd just printed.
So I don't know if you're aware of this, but at the height of the Depression, before FDR came in with his big spending programs, there were approximately 3,100 counties in America. And there were approximately 3,100 local currencies in America, because people realized this. They needed a way to transact, and there was economic activity that wanted to happen. And so people created local currencies. And then when the tsunami of money came in through the New Deal, it basically wiped out the local currencies. And I've always believed intuitively there was a reason.
Exactly. Yes, it's true. It was the same also in Germany in the 1920s. Lots of local currencies sprang up, and then 1930s again. But the central banks always clamped down on this.
Right.
They clearly didn't like that. But it's possible. It can be done. And I think we should prepare the systems for this, because that's the important thing to understand. There is no reason why in a crisis situation, we should not be able to expand the money supply. They will have another squeeze.
Yeah, absolutely.
They will try to then take everyone's assets, collateral or otherwise, in a squeeze where they reduce the money supply. But it's possible, if you just, you know, have local public institutions or state-level institutions, could be county, could be town, city institutions, to expand the money supply. And hold against this. And that has, when it happened, it has been always very successful.
So here's the state of play in America. And this is just my anecdotal experience. You know, the state legislators are being hit with a tsunami of proposals to help with the land grab. And they're being hit with a tsunami of proposals to encourage sound money, whether it's gold, it's pretty much gold and silver because of their constitutional provisions. But when you try to focus them on the bank and the importance, you know, it should be all the state chartered banks who are in the state legislature saying, we need this to make sure we're protected when the boom, you know, when the game is upon us. But the bankers are not in the door and pressing for this. And so what I'm trying to figure out is, how do I help the state legislatures understand this is the most important thing? Without this, you know, we can do a lot to protect the land, and we can do a lot to make sure the state has bullion and a bullion depository and all sorts of other things, which I think are great ideas. But without the train tracks for fundamental financial liquidity, we're toast. How do I make this case?
Yes, yes. Well, I suppose the case for a state-level bank is one that sort of unifies a lot of these possibilities in one institution. Of course, you can also do it differently, but by having a bank, a lot of people, you know, quickly understand what you mean, and they mm-hmm. see the advantage. And there's the example of the Bank of North Dakota, state-level bank that's backing all the banks in that state, and that's been very, very successful. It's been going strong for a century. So it's a concrete proposal of what can be done. And right. setting up a bank, you know, a bank is basically an accounting ledger, and the rest is common sense with some, you know, good accounting and some business experience. So it can be done. Every state could have it. The money you need is very limited. It can be provided by the state and will not be lost. In fact, will be increased by being right. a shareholder in that bank. And of course, citizens could also join. I mean, that's however you want to set it up. So I think that's a very concrete way of trying to explain it. Money is created by banks. Well, let's have a state bank to make sure we have state level money provision whenever needed.
So I'm headed back to Tennessee next week, and I'm hoping I can get with more bankers and find out. So the other thing I'm finding, Richard, as I travel in America, is it is remarkable how many very intelligent, educated, aware people have no idea that a total control grid is coming their way. They don't see it, and they don't understand the danger of it. And you, not only are you remarkable in your ability to explain why we can have an abundant economy, but also, and I think that's important because I believe we do need a reset of some kind. And but, you know, I would like a reset that builds wealth and keeps us free. But you're also very remarkable at warning people about the control grid that's coming. If we don't do these things,
yes,
we will find ourselves in a very bad place. So maybe if you could just describe why, you know, why it is essential to provide this kind of banking capacity and infrastructure, and what will happen if we don't. And I really want the bankers to understand, because they're all going to lose their businesses.
Exactly. That's right. So it started with, the thin edge of a wedge was the creation of the Federal Reserve, and the central planners have ever since been anti-bank. In the 1930s, when push came to shove, the Federal Reserve ensured that more than 10,000 small local banks went bust and depositors lost their money. And the Federal Reserve could have prevented this, but was quite happy with what happened. And that is the track record. And since then, post-war, number of banks just going down and down and down, the same in Europe. This is what central banks want. They want to concentrate their power. Ultimately, where they're heading, they want to be the only bank in town. And the big accelerator for this is central bank digital currency.
Right.
You know, a digital dollar will drastically accelerate this trend and give total power to the central planners. Because ultimately, it's the central bank saying, okay, well, we're not just the bank regulator. Actually, we're now going to take away the business from the banks, and we're going to do that business. You're going to have an account with the central bank, which of course is the unfairest competition you can imagine. You know, if the umpire steps into the game and says, I'm going to score the goals now.
It's also a takeover of the fiscal side of the house, because now you have taxation without representation.
Exactly. And CBDCs, which are programmable, they are actually also fiscal policy. And mm-hmm. that means you're taking away the last area of power that politicians have had, whether they've used it wisely or not, which is fiscal policy. Normally you have parliament, you have votes, you know, about budgets and all that. Well, that's going to disappear because it was all be decided by the central bank, how resources will be allocated.
Right.
And there will be technical reasons why this is more efficient, we will be told, you know, but clearly it is the central planners, not just tackling the banks. They're also going to take away power from legislature.
They can program all the policies into your money. So If they don't want you traveling more than 15 minutes from your home, your money won't work 15 minutes. All those policies can be, you know, built
exactly.
into.
And they're doing this at the moment under the guise of, oh, it's because there's a climate crisis, they claim. Therefore, we need to just act, and we can't worry too much about these constitutional details and political details. We just need to tell the banks, okay, for these and these things, you're not allowed to lend anymore. And nobody's stopping them. They're already grabbing the power that is absolutely not theirs to make these resource allocation decisions. And that will only get worse. I mean, the other maybe concrete example is again in the 1930s, this, you know, in the Great Depression in Europe, in fact, in Austria, which was as much in the Great Depression as Germany, the economy was shrinking, unemployment was 25%, and there was a town called Vergel in Tyrol, North Tyrol, in Austria, and the mayor had been a bit of a thinker, reading books about the economy, and he was aware of money creation and so on. So this mayor faced the situation where a quarter of the population or of the working population was unemployed and therefore not working. But he had lots of work to do. There was bridges to build, roads needed mending, some public buildings needed construction. There was so much work. And he thought, this is crazy. You know, the community, the local community needs these jobs done. And here all these people unemployed. Well, I'm just going to hire them. Well, I don't have the money. So, you know, we're given the impression, oh, there's a resource constraint. But everyone can see that this is nonsense, right?
Right.
The people are there. They want to work.
Right.
And also, you know, the mayor has jobs to do. But the system would give you this impression and would want you to believe, oh, there's nothing you can do. It's a crisis. These people have to be unemployed and know these jobs can't be done.
This is exactly what Guernsey Island did, which I love that story.
Exactly. That's the same story.
They just started making money. And, you know, of course, we have a history in America. Every time a president tries to do this by issuing currency from the Treasury, he tends to get assassinated or
get shot. Get shot is the tradition, I think. Yeah. Whether it's what is Garfield or Lincoln or Kennedy.
Jackson tried to shut down the central bank. He took a bullet and lived, which is, you know, the Tennessee guys are tough.
Yes. No. So this mayor then issued, he was careful. He called it a receipt for work done to the community. And that's true, right?
Right.
If you worked 8 hours building the road for the local community, of course, we're going to give you a receipt confirming your job done. And then he persuaded his wife, who was running a local grocery shop, to accept this, to buy it. Of course, the poor guy needs to buy food now. And of course, you're going to accept it, aren't you? He's worked for our community. Okay. Well, I need to get the, you know, all the groceries from the farmers. Hopefully the farmers, well, they will see the document and, you know, I am as a mayor have signed and they work for us. And so everyone accepted this. So it was like printing money.
Yeah.
And it worked. And it really became boom town. So all these people were then employed. Unemployment was zero. And of course, all the next villages were starting to do the same thing. And it really then actually made a big change. It was national news, then international news. Irving Fisher from the U.S. had his researcher flown in to interview people and find out more. And that's when the central planners stepped into the picture, the Austrian Central Bank.
Right.
And of course, their argument was very clear. What was happening was criminal because they've been working very hard on creating this Great Depression together with other central bankers. And, you know, they spent the previous decade in creating all these conditions and then busting the banking system and reducing credit creation and getting everyone into record unemployment. And there's this lowly mayor just ending the Great Depression without their permission. So clearly he was a criminal and he was literally threatened with, the public prosecutor threatened him then with imprisonment if he didn't, under charges of forgery or all sorts of things.
So
if he
this
didn't
is
stop,
why
he stopped and the whole place went back into the Great Depression and the central right. bankers were happy. And that shows you on which right. side the central planners are.
So this is why when you do this the next time, you want to keep it secret. No media, just sneaking around, right?
Yes, it can be done
yeah.
because we have the means, you know. It is not as if you need great technology to do this. Even right. simple paper receipts can do the job. We have, you know, you mentioned Bitcoin. Bitcoin has right. a public key and a private key, which is a bit like, you know, the old system of tally sticks, which they used to have. Here's one. Uh-huh. They used to have this in the Norman Exchequer in England. It was in place actually for 800 years. And you have notches here to yeah. denote a particular amount. This is 2,123 pounds and a few pennies.
Wow.
And then it was split. And the short one is the foil, which was kept in the Royal Treasury. The uh-huh. long one was the stock, which circulated as evidence that you've paid your taxes. And because of that, could be used in the Exchequer as tax evidence that you've paid taxes. It was therefore used as money. And the government could go out and spend with this. It was forgery proof because, of course, with money, the important thing is, you know, can it be forged right. or not? But it's like a fingerprint, you know, the grain right. in the wood, the grainage is unique. And if you wanted to check, they fit together, then they tallied. And if the foil did not match the tally stick, the stock, then you were foiled. And so this is where our right. expressions come from, including the expression for the check, because there was a big chessboard-sized abacus. Uh-huh. After which the Exchequer is named, and that's where the word check comes from, which was used for the calculations for the system. So this is a monetary system, and it's like Bitcoin, public key, mm-hmm. private key, where you check whether they fit together. So it can be paper, it can be wood, it can be just an Excel spreadsheet on, say, the local right. mayor's, town mayor's computer, maybe sealed off from the internet. And right. everyone has their name in there, and you can just create tax credits and shift them around and have bookings. So there's many, many possibilities. But of course, having a bank, a local right. bank, do it because they specialize in this as their daily right. business is the easiest. And there's already a lot of credibility. And that's right. why strengthening local banking and have state level banks is probably in terms of just having the ready infrastructure for local level money creation allocation is probably ideal.
Right. And I'm a great believer it is essential at the local and then the state level to have systems that are both analog and digital. You need both. It's not one or the other. You need both. And
exactly.
that's why, you know, one of the many reasons I keep promoting cash, because you need to avoid an all digital system, because that's where you get into the central control.
Yes, and of course there can be power outages, there can be cyber attacks, right. we're told. So, so yes, it's good to have analog equivalents.
One of my favorite reforms from Bill Binney is he said, you got to get the homeschoolers doing cryptography and encryption, because if the young people are constantly changing the local, you know, encryption systems, he said, it'll drive the NS crazy. They won't be able to handle it. Okay, so you're going to hopefully come to the United States in the spring.
Yes.
And I absolutely want to get you with some of the legislators in the southern states in a format where we can do some people locally, but we can also broadcast it so the other legislators can come in who can't necessarily travel to, you know, maybe we do it in the Knoxville area or the Nashville area, somewhere there. Anyway, but I want you to promise me that you will give me some dates so that we can organize that. And I would encourage everybody listening to this, please read Richard's wonderful paper, Why a State Sovereign Bank is Such a Great Idea. It's in the Future of Financial Freedom, but it's also up on the website. Just do Richard Werner. You'll also pick up his Case for Abundance in Malmo and links to his website. And if you haven't read or seen The Princes of the Yen, it's a must. And of course, you'll find his website too. So Richard, I just can't thank you enough for your work. And we need to get your message, you know, clearly in front of the policymakers in America who are making these decisions and are pressured from all sides to help the other team do the land grab. And they they want to shut off the liquidity. They know, I mean, they did it in the 30s. They shut off the liquidity and they were able to pick up the land cheap, and they want to do it again. And we can't let that happen. And exactly. I think you know more than anyone about how to stop that. So I just got to get you in front of everybody. So you send me your schedule and we'll do it. Okay.
Excellent. Let's do that. Very good.
Okay. Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on the Solari Report. You have a wonderful day, and do me a favor, you know, get those Richard Warner materials out to your state legislature and your local and state policy leaders. We and to your banker, please get it to your banker, because Richard Warner can save their business, and it's under threat, and they need to know that. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank. Yeah.
And I was just about to say the book Princes of the Yen, on Amazon, totally overpriced, crazy. It's best on quantumpublishers.com.
Oh,
that's
good.
Where you can order it directly for a normal price.
What's the price up to on Amazon?
Sometimes it can be more than $100, $500, $800, anything.
They know how to shut. And, you know, there's a new form of censorship, and it's very subtle. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Thank you, Richard. Ladies and gentlemen, have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much.